doubts regarding your ability. Lead them, the men. Lead them. There are doubts in your ability. There's too many blinds in your analogy.
Alright, my friends, welcome to Anti-War Radio for April the 3rd, 2007. I'm your host, Scott Horton. You can find what I write occasionally at antiwar.com and my own blog, thestressblog.com. And this is Anti-War Radio. For the first time, going live for 2 hours. We're going to have a recorded interview about a half an hour from now. From that I recorded on Sunday. But from now on, the new format is 11 to 1 every day here on Chaos Radio 95.9, 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. And of course, all the interviews will be podcasted from antiwar.com. Got plenty of news to talk about, and got a call-in number, too, if anybody wants to get involved on the show. It's 512-646-6446. That's 512-646-6446. And I'll be taking your calls. But also got plenty of news to talk about. And I wanted to start with this one. I think most of y'all have probably been keeping track, at least somewhat, of the 15 British sailors and Marines that were captured by the Iranians. And and the conflict over Britain getting their guys back. And this is the link is from antiwar.com this morning. You can find it at theglobeandmail.com. London, the Iranian prisoner crisis revealed a widening schism between Britain and the United States Sunday as U.S. leaders called for tough action and British officials confirmed that they were trying to free their 15 imprisoned sailors by quietly reaching a compromise with Tehran. The headline, Washington hurting British bid to free crew. Here the British, after talking tough for a couple of days, realized the weak position they were in. They couldn't prove their case that that their sailors were definitely in Iranian waters. So apparently they've decided they're going to back down from some of their heightened rhetoric and try to work out a deal with the Iranians, and the United States is intervening to make sure that doesn't happen. Sort of like Israel's almost peace deal with the Syrians that the United States botched just a couple of months ago. Continuing from the Globe and Mail today. British officials believe that Iran is not seeking a prisoner exchange or any other further bounty in exchange for the sailors, who have been imprisoned for 10 days, and they are hoping the crisis can be resolved peacefully in the next few days. As two more British sailors were shown Sunday night in another Iranian broadcast reading confessions, and a small crowd of radical students in Tehran threw rocks and firecrackers at the British embassy there, British diplomats exchanged letters with the Iranian foreign ministry seeking a conciliatory end to the standoff. Officials in London said they believe their confidence-building operations, in which they offer to guarantee the Iranian government that British vessels will not stray into Iranian waters, offer the best hope of winning the freedom of the sailors and Marines who have been in custody since they were seized by Iran's Republican Guards on March 23rd. Iran said the sailors had strayed into Iranian waters. Britain says they remained in Iraqi waters, where they are allowed to operate in support of the Iraq war. Yeah, allowed by who? I like that part. You know, what right do the British have in Iraqi waters in the first place? But I guess that's besides the point. And for anyone who watches TV to get their news, you may be under the false impression that it's an open and shut case somehow that those British sailors were, in fact, in Iranian waters. But you would be mistaken. Former ambassador, Great Britain's ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, has his website is craigmurray.com, and in fact, on Anti-War Radio yesterday, Charles Goyette got a great interview with Craig Murray. It's up at the top of antiwar.com right now. And he's an expert in these waterways, and I believe particularly in the Persian Gulf region, had been responsible for monitoring Iraqi shipments during the oil for food program during the blockade of the 1990s and the earliest part of the 21st century here. And so he knows for a fact that the Shat al-Arab waterway, where all this happened, is in dispute. There are no lines. There are no buoys that say, you know, this way Iran, that way Iraq. The only border that's ever been decided there is the land border. And there are no lines. And further, that the map that was put out by the British government was basically just pure propaganda. It's just pure lies based on, well, not much. First of all, the lines that are purported to exist on that map do not exist. And then second of all, I don't think at this date either side has proven their case of the exact location of where the boats even were in the first place. So, in fact, Craig Murray pointed out to Charles Goyette on his show yesterday that where the British say that they were extremely shallow waters, where it seems unlikely that you would have had the boats in that position, that kind of thing. So, at the very least, you know, preface your understanding of this so-called hostage crisis with disputed and not sure yet and so forth, because it is not definite for Tony Blair and for George Bush and the rest of these guys to come out and just blatantly accuse the Iranians of crossing into Iraqi waters to kidnap these soldiers. It's just, it doesn't hold water. And you know, a lot of people who've been warily looking toward a war with Iran as this out-of-control Bush regime seems to be forever marching towards it. Many have predicted a Gulf of Tonkin-type situation. If you remember the Downing Street memos, they talked about the British and the American government at the very highest levels, talked about painting up a U-2 spy plane to look like a UN plane and getting it shot down or at least fired upon over Iraq so that they could start the war early and try to pretend that Iraq started it, not the United States and Britain. So it's hardly beyond the pale for them to deliberately create these kind of circumstances. And as Philip Giraldi pointed out on the show yesterday, the rules of engagement of Americans doing the same kind of missions that the British were doing would have been to resist. Where the British surrendered and were captured, the Americans have been instructed to fire their weapons. And so if this same kind of thing had happened to American sailors instead of British ones, we might well have our war at this point. It should be remembered that this very same thing happened, basically, where Iranians captured British Marines back in 2004, just 3 years ago, after the war in Iraq had already begun and all that. And they sent diplomats in pinstripe suits and they worked it out. This is not a casus belli. It's not an excuse for war, but it's the kind of thing that could be turned into one if the situation drags on. And again, from the UK, from the Globe and Mail this morning, the link at the top of antiwar.com, Washington hurting British bid to free crew. Here the British are trying to negotiate the release of their sailors and Marines, and the United States is intervening. Saying, oh, you've adopted a conciliatory tone? Here, let us go out and be belligerent in front of the microphone. Just to put off any possible breakthrough in diplomacy a little bit longer. You know, great. That's your government doing that. And yeah, so anyway, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Again, the phone number if anybody wants to call in and get involved on the air, it's 646-6446 here in Austin, Texas, 646-6446. And if you're from out of town, put a 512 in front of it there, 512-646-6446. And also I have here from The Independent, from Patrick Coburn, a little bit of backstory about this raid. The botched U.S. raid that led to the hostage crisis, this, of course, from The Independent. by Patrick Coburn. A failed American attempt to abduct two senior Iranian security officers on an official visit to northern Iraq was the starting pistol for a crisis that 10 weeks later led to Iranians seizing 15 British sailors and Marines. Early on the morning of 11 January, helicopter-borne U.S. forces launched a surprise raid on a long-established Iranian liaison office in the city of Arbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. They captured five relatively junior Iranian officials, whom the U.S. accuses of being intelligence agents and still holds. In reality, the U.S. attack had a far more ambitious objective, the Independent has learned. The aim of the raid, launched without informing Kurdish authorities, was to seize two men at the very heart of the Iranian security establishment. Better understanding of the seriousness of the U.S. action in Arbil and the angry Iranian response to it should have led Downing Street and the Ministry of Defense to realize that Iran was likely to retaliate against American or British forces, such as highly vulnerable Navy search parties in the Gulf. The two senior Iranian officers the U.S. sought to capture were Mohammad Jafari, a powerful deputy head of the Iranian National Security Council, and General Minojahar Farzanda, the chief of intelligence of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, according to Kurdish officials. The two men were in Kurdistan on an official visit, during which they met the Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, and later saw Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan regional government, at his mountain headquarters overlooking Arbil. They were after Jafari, Fawad Hussein, the chief of staff of Masoud Barzani, told The Independent. He confirmed that the Iranian office had been established in Arbil for a long time and was often visited by Kurds obtaining documents to visit Iran. The Americans thought Jafari was there, said Mr. Hussein. Mr. Jafari was accompanied by a second high-ranking Iranian official. His name was General Minjahar Frauzanda, the head of intelligence of the Pasdaran Iranian Revolutionary Guard, said Saadi Ahmed Pir, now head of the Diwan office of President Talabani in Baghdad. Mr. Pirer previously lived in Arbil, where he headed the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, PUK, Mr. Talabani's political party. The attempt by the U.S. to seize the two high-ranking Iranian security officers, openly meeting with Iraqi leaders, is somewhat as if Iran had tried to kidnap the heads of the CIA and MI6 while they were on an official visit to a country neighboring Iran, such as Pakistan or Afghanistan. There is no doubt that Iran believes that Mr. Jafari and Mr. Frauzanda were targeted by the Americans. Mr. Jafari confirmed to the Iranian news agency IRNA that he was in Arbil at the time of the raid. In a little notice remark, Manochehr Mottaki, the Iranian foreign minister, told IRNA, IRNA, the objective of the Americans was to arrest Iranian security officials who had gone to Iraq to develop cooperation in the area of bilateral security. U.S. officials in Washington subsequently claimed that the five Iranian officials they did seize, who have not been seen since, were, quote, suspected of being closely tied to activities targeting Iraq and coalition forces. This explanation never made much sense. No member of the U.S.-led coalition has been killed in Arbil, and there were no Sunni Arab insurgents or Shia militiamen there. The raid on Arbil took place within hours of President George Bush making an address to the nation on 10 January, in which he claimed Iran is providing material support for attacks on American troops. He identified Iran and Syria as America's main enemies in Iraq, though the four-year-old guerrilla war against U.S.-led forces is being conducted by the strongly anti-Iranian Sunni Arab community. Mr. Jafari himself later complained about U.S. allegations. So far, has there been a single Iranian among suicide bombers in the war-battered country, he asked? Almost all who are involved in the suicide attacks are from Arab countries. And of course, since you've all graduated from elementary school, you know that Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians, which is an entirely different ethnicity there. It seems strange at the time that the U.S. would so openly flout the authority of the Iraqi president and the head of the KRG simply to raid an Iranian liaison office that was being upgraded to a consulate, though this had not happened on 11 January. U.S. officials, who must have been privy to the White House's new anti-Iranian stance, may have thought that bruised Kurdish pride was a small price to pay if the U.S. could grab such senior Iranian officials. For more than a year, the U.S. and its allies have been trying to put pressure on Iran. Security sources in Iraqi Kurdistan have long said that the U.S. is backing Iranian Kurdish guerrillas in Iran. The U.S. is also reportedly backing Sunni Arab dissidents in Khuzestan in southern Iran, who are opposed to the government in Tehran. On February 4th, soldiers from the Iraqi Army 36th Commando Battalion in Baghdad, considered to be under American control, seized Jalal Shafari, an Iranian diplomat. The raid in Erbil was far more serious and aggressive act. It was not carried out by proxies, but by U.S. forces directly. The abortive Erbil raid provoked a dangerous escalation in the confrontation between the U.S. and Iran, which ultimately led to the capture of the 15 British sailors and Marines, apparently considered a more vulnerable coalition target than their American comrades. And that, again, is one of the world's great investigative reporters, Patrick Coburn, reporting from Kurdistan for the London Independent. There you go. It's tit for tat, and he doesn't really get into the article too much about what a joke it is that somehow Iran is behind the Sunni insurgency against the Americans. It's, of course, our allies, the Egyptians and the Saudis, who are backing the Sunni insurgency against the United States, and it is and America's taking the side of the Iranian factions in Iraq. How do you like that for a bunch of crap set straight? Thanks again to Patrick Coburn from the London Independent. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. And before I get to this interview, which is a really great one, it's with a guy named Sami Rasuli, who is an Iraqi who lived in Minneapolis for 30 years. Was an expatriate, lived here in the United States, a successful restaurateur, owned Sinbad's restaurant in Minneapolis. And since the war, he's moved back to Iraq. And I talked with him Sunday afternoon about his time there and why he wants America, the American government, to leave his country post-haste. That's a great interview, and he's, of course, on his way back to Iraq before too long. So I'll be playing that at the bottom of the hour. It runs about 50 minutes, but I wanted to talk about libertarianism here real quick, if possible. There's been a few confounding, I guess, articles and appearances on TV in the last week that have just really kind of caught my attention, caught my interest, and I thought maybe I can help clear some things up for those who are confused. The New York Times, in reviewing Radicals for Capitalism, a freewheeling history of the modern American libertarian movement by Brian Doherty, explained that libertarianism had been discredited by George Bush's war in Iraq. Huh? What the hell are they talking about? Well, apparently, when the United States invaded and took possession of Iraq's industries, they just turned around, sold them all off to the highest bidder. And the highest bidders, of course, were mostly foreign interests who just liquidated the industries and closed them down, basically. Took all the money they could and shut it down. Because, of course, the long-term security situation in Iraq was not going to get better, but only worse. And so they knew better than to try to run any of these industries. They'd just go ahead and go. But is that libertarianism? Is that the free market operating? To have the biggest government program in the history of the world, that is the United States military, spend taxed dollars to violently and aggressively invade a foreign country, take their assets, and give them away, basically, to politically connected interests? Is that libertarianism? Only if you're the New York Times is that libertarianism. God, I hope. It seems like you would have to be, you know, as retarded as the average New York Times writer to come up with a conclusion like that. But there you have it. Now that libertarianism, not really as a political party in any sense, but the libertarian movement is spreading like wildfire, and they don't know what to do about it except lie about it. They know that there are a lot of young people who hate Republicans and yet are not Marxists. Uh-oh. We can't have all these people becoming, beginning to believe in true American Jeffersonian principles like individual liberty and limited government, the Bill of Rights, private property, capitalism, etc. No, we can't have that. So let's call the war in Iraq libertarianism. That'll discredit it. That's the New York Times. And then there's a great reporter. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm sure it's excellent. It's called Blackwater by Jeremy Scahill. He's a reporter for Democracy Now. And I don't know his whole bio, but he's done a lot of great reporting since at least the late 1990s. And he's got this massive new 400-page book about Blackwater and the private armies, the mercenaries that this government is employing, particularly in the war in Iraq. And I heard a great interview with him on Truth Dig the other day. And all through the interview, both he and the interviewer are talking about the privatization of this and that. Security, police, and military forces, etc. And there was no distinction made at all between the government, say, you know, a local sheriff's department in North Carolina, hiring Blackwater thugs and deputizing them and giving them police power. And a local, you know, JCPenney hiring Burns security to stand out back and guard the door. They could not. They did not. And it's because, you know, no offense to Jeremy Scahill because he's a great reporter, but because he's one brand of socialist or another, I guess, he just can't tell the difference between private power that is spending money they justly acquired on their own interests and the government hiring these private companies to protect their interests and to go around exercising their very public police power. Well, there's an incredible difference between those things. You hiring your own security guard or the local sheriff's department hiring a private security guard force to enforce their public laws. These are entirely different things. And, of course, the former being perfectly okay and the latter being fascism. And so I hope that made a little bit of sense. The Iraq War is not libertarianism. Blackwater working on bazillion-dollar government contracts is not the free market, is not libertarianism. And the worst example of this, and, you know, this guy Bill Maher, I never liked Bill Maher. I guess he was okay sometimes back when he was on the Comedy Channel, but especially by the time they put him on network TV or whatever, the guy's just a joke. And, you know, he was okay for a liberal Democrat type, I guess, for a little while there on the Comedy Channel. But you'd never believe it. I mean, it's just crazy, right? But Bill Maher calls himself a libertarian. Bill Maher a libertarian? Bill Maher who never stops praising Hillary Clinton? You know, Bill Maher, the host of Politically Correct, is a libertarian? Well, that was put to the test the other night when he interviewed a real libertarian, that is Dr. Ron Paul, who will be a guest on the show tomorrow, on this show tomorrow. And he put Ron Paul through the ringer and just thought he was going to just smear Ron Paul and trick him into saying unpopular things and this and that. And Ron Paul just creamed him. And why? Because Bill Maher doesn't have any idea what he's talking about. Not only is he an asshole, he's also stupid. Obviously, he says to Ron Paul, he says, well, obviously you have to have government. I mean, I'm a libertarian, but you have to have government. What about the FAA? If it wasn't for the FAA, it would be a disaster. And I think Ron Paul actually kind of misunderstood the question because he answered, yes, you're right. The FAA could be privatized. We don't need a government FAA at all. Just look at Just look at the FAA and what how they failed on September 11th. Making it the law that you're not allowed to resist hijackers. Making it the law that pilots are not allowed to carry their own 38. Making it the law that, well, with the law, setting up the structures of communication between the FAA, the airlines, and the military, and et cetera, et cetera. The FAA does nothing but fail. And the TSA, the transportation security guys, are, of course, far worse than the private security companies that monitored and guarded the airports before September 11th. We all know, we see the headlines when FBI agents sneak in fake bombs doing their tests, that they succeed 100% of the time, that they can sneak in fake bombs and fake guns and knives and whatever they want. We're talking about federal employees who are testing the procedures that the security's a joke. And Ron Paul says, you got to be kidding me. The FAA? Why do you need the government to run the FAA? Come on. And then Bill Maher says, oh, now I'm a libertarian, but doesn't the Walter Reed scandal prove the dangers of the profit motive in healthcare? And Ron Paul just laughs at him and says, well, my friend, I don't know where you ever got the idea that Walter Reed was private. He left off, you dumb ass. He didn't say that. Walter Reed is government health care. Walter Reed is what happens when you socialize health care in America, and there is not a profit motive giving the incentive to the people running the place to do a good job. And what do you get? You get American heroic freedom fighter amputees laying in piles of rat shit. That's a failure of the market, Mr. Maher? That's a failure of liberty as opposed to a failure of the state which you champion? And one more, and I've heard this two or three different places now, that in the media they're referring to Rudolph Giuliani, presidential candidate, as a libertarian. Rudolph Giuliani, who is for every law that was ever passed. Rudolph Giuliani, who, and you can go to the Pro Libertate blog and read Will Griggs' writings all about it, where he quotes Giuliani outright saying, look, the definition of freedom is your obedience to my authority. Blah. Where he comes right out, that's Rudolph Giuliani's core belief system, that freedom means doing what he says. And here's a guy who is the exact opposite of libertarian. But, you know, if you are know-nothing, numbskull writing newspaper articles or producing TV news, and you didn't know your ass from the hole in the ground, well, geez, I guess you might think that Giuliani was a libertarian too, right? He's a moderate. He's a centrist. He's surely not a right-wing conservative Republican, is he? No. He's a moderate centrist. Well, wait a minute. Maybe he's a centrist, but he's not a moderate. Maybe he's a centrist, but he's an extremist. Maybe that's where the extremists truly are, is in the center. And maybe that's Rudolph Giuliani's problem, is that if he was conservative, he would at least have some principle besides everyone ought to do what he says. Instead, he's a moderate. Moderately for what? Taking your guns away? Moderately for supporting global democratic revolution and regime change throughout the Middle East? Moderately in favor of the federal drug war against your liberty? Moderately in favor of the national government taking over all your local police departments and state guard units? Is that how moderate Rudy Giuliani is? Moderately in favor of the Military Commissions Act and the Patriot Act and all the rest of that? Is Giuliani moderate when he comes out and says, we must, this is only a month or two ago, we must praise George Bush for his excellent leadership in the war? Is that what makes Rudolph Giuliani a libertarian or a moderate? No. See, he's a fascist. See, the centrists are not the moderates. The centrists are the extremists. And now there are extremists on the right and the left as well, but nowadays, especially in a time of empire and war like we have right now, the extremes on the right and the left tend to default toward liberty rather than toward the state. It's those uneducated, centrist, moderated influences on the right and the left that favor all this total statism. But, you know, maybe that's just me. Anyway, so thanks for nothing, assholes, for not calling in for the first half hour here. If you want to not call in after this interview's over, you could also not call 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446. And now I'm going to play for you my wonderful interview of Sammy Rasuli from 2 days ago, Sunday, April 1st. For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. All right, that thing is fucking up. I forgot. I have to, every single time, I have to change the settings on this thing so that it does not sound terrible like that. So that's why they call this Chaos Radio, and, you know, I don't really care if you don't like it. This is a really stupid sound card. You got to change its settings every single time you use it. Isn't that great? All right. Cool. Well, so it should be set now. Let's try this. For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio.
Captain, there are doubts.
I have on the line Sammy Rasuli. He is a Iraqi who was an expatriate, lived in the United States for, I believe, about 30 years, a very successful restaurateur from Minneapolis, owner of Sinbad's Restaurant. And since the war, he has moved back to Iraq and has created something called the Muslim Peacekeeper Team, a Shiite Muslim from Najaf, Iraq. Welcome to the show, Sammy.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
Nice to make your acquaintance here. Sure. And now, did I get that right? You're a Shiite originally from Najaf?
Well, yes. I was born and raised in Najaf. Najaf is considered as a Shiite city, populated mostly by Shiites, but always there are a Christian here, and there are Sunnis too, and in the old days, there were Jews, actually, in this city. And until now, there is an alley called Jewish Alley. Used to be Jews there wholesaling, manufacturing shoes, and wholesale it to the main bazaar, which is adjacent to the alley. And actually, they own most of the shops in that main bazaar. This is before the 1948.
Uh-huh.
And Iraq, which known as that beautiful treasure of the wonderful mosaic fabric of society, actually, it's not about only Shiites and Sunnis that live in Iraq. There are other sects, the Mandaeen, the Sabia, the John Baptist sects, and also there are the Yazidis, who mm-hmm. are held as satanic worshippers, and actually they deny this, but they live in Sinjar, in a place where the Nineveh province is in the north, and they have a nice story. The Yazidis back on September 2005, when the city of Tel Afar was bombed by the U.S. Force, Air Force, forcing lots of Sunnis and Shiites who lived in Tel Afar, forcing them to leave.
This was cited as a great success by the president.
Well, the success and the progress I always keep hearing from this administration, it's nothing but destruction in Iraq. But the Yazidis, who saw those Shiites and Sunnis families seeking refuge from their city in Sinjar, they hosted them. They opened their homes and hearts and told them, please stay here as long as you want. And we know you're not holding us as clean as you are. We're going to leave you here, and we go stay with our relatives at to that point you feel you're safe. You can go back home. But they never did, because the agony and the problem of Iraq today has been going on since last 40 years.
So they have had no opportunity to go back home?
No, actually they came down. This story was narrated to me by the second Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Saeed al-Hakim in Najaf when I visited him with a group of Muslim peacemakers teams along with the Christian peacemakers team such as Sister Peggy Gish and Michelle Obednar. That was back in January 2006, last year actually. We learned about this story, and the Tal Afar people, Shiites and Sunnis, were in Najaf and Karbala, that we tried to supply them with some food, clothing, and shelter. And today, Scott, as may you know, and your listeners, there are 4 million Iraqis has been displaced, at least for the last 2 years. 2 million are displaced inside their own country as refugees, and other 2 million are outside Iraq. And most of those 4 million are the middle class, which for all of us to survive.
Sami Rasuli, he's an Iraqi-American. For 30 years, lived in Minneapolis and is a successful businessman, owner of Sinbad's Restaurant. He now lives in Iraq. He's back here to beg us, please, withdraw our military from his now again home country. Please Google and read all about Sami Rasuli, S-A-M-I. R-A-S-O-U-L-I. R-A-S-O-U-L-I. Thank you so much for your time today, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and that was my interview with Sami Rasuli, Iraqi-American, who's lives there now but is back here begging us to force our politicians to remove our military from his country. A really great guy, and if you Google his name, you can read all about his various trips back and forth to and from Iraq in the last few years since the war. And it's S-A-M-I, Sami Rasuli. Where is it? Let me make sure I get it right. R-A-S-O-U-L-I. R-A-S-O-U-L-I. Sami Rasuli. And there's a lot of very interesting interviews of him out there, and a lot of essays that he's written, letters home and that kind of thing, of great interest. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. If you want the archives of my interviews, there's probably, you know, I don't know how many, 250, 300 something interviews maybe, by now at scotthortonshow.com. And, my blog is thestressblog.com. And, of course, this show is a joint production with antiwar.com for Anti-War Radio. I'll post all the interviews, all the new interviews go up at antiwar.com, which is, not just to spout the slogan, but I really mean it, the best place for anti-war news, viewpoints, and activities. So check out antiwar.com there. And the phone number here is 646-646-646-6446 if anybody wants to get involved on the air, and put a 512 in front of that. If you're from outside Austin, calling long distance, that's 512-646-6446. And I have plenty of news here in case you don't. I want a message here to the younger guys out there in the audience, the guys and gals too. Don't join the military. Don't do it. And I know there are a lot of wide and varied reasons put forward for why to join the military, but I got some reasons why not to. And I really wish every time I see one of those military ads on TV that I was, you know, my dad always said I was better born lucky than rich. And, that's proving to be the case, but I don't have the millions of dollars I wish I had that I could just put on mock military commercials or just, you know, play their commercials and but just talk over them and say, for example, you notice how they never show Iraq in any commercials for joining the military? They always show these guys in the plane, they're over the ocean or they're over, you know, looks like maybe Tennessee down there. Yeah, join the army. We never go to Iraq. You know, just for starters. And then all the propaganda about here's how to talk to your parents. If your parents don't want you to join the military, well, don't worry. We'll take your side and help you argue with them. And here's the best way to say, Mom, you just don't understand. This is something I gotta do. And how manipulative is that? I mean, if the commercials for the military aren't reason enough to just reject, you know, I mean, maybe that's just me, but when I see commercials for, you know, whatever kind of product it is that is just insulting to me, I make it a point to not buy that. Or else, you know, it's working. You know, their advertising's working and I want to make it not work. I believe in market forces, you know, and if the military's advertising campaign was, you know, any symbol of the kind of people who put out their product that is, you know, enslaving you and forcing you to go kill strangers and get killed by them, by playing the IED lottery in your aluminum Humvee, then, you know, I think the commercials alone ought to be enough to dissuade anyone from wanting to join, but maybe people just aren't cynical enough when they see those commercials. But they say that you need this money for college. Well, you know what? You can go to college without joining the military, even if you're poor. If you have moderately good grades, there are a million ways to go to college. I mean, let's face it, the government taxes everybody and forces them to pay for these universities, whether they go to them or not. And they're everywhere. And you can get a degree, man, without joining the military first. You can get a degree in hard science if that's your gig. But you don't have to join the military first. Do they give you money for college? Well, I think even that's debatable. Some people say, hell yeah, I got, you know, this much money and it paid for my college, but I hear the horror stories too. Oh, last minute technicality, not only are we not paying for your college, you owe us money. How do you like that? So, you may want to go to college, and I'd encourage you to go and seek a higher education if you can get one. And always cross-examine your teachers, because they're not always right about everything. But, you don't need to join the military to go to college. And of course, they say, you know, you're fighting for your country, service to your country. And I guess probably most people listening to Chaos Radio would never fall for that one. But many people do. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, if the Germans and the British and the Russians and the French all teamed up and sent their navies to land a beachhead in North Carolina or something, I'd hop in the pickup truck with the boys and we'd get rifles one way or another and we would go and shoot them until they stopped trying to invade our country. I'm not talking about civilian immigrants. Obviously, I'm talking about, you know, a military invasion of this country. Sure. If I was on a hijacked plane, would I be one of the people to volunteer to go up there and try to kill the hijacker? Of course I would. You know, I'll defend my country. If that's service to my country, that's really just self-defense in that case, but, or in either case. But really those things ought to be inseparable, right? If you're not actually threatened, then how is the nation threatened? You know, if there was an invasion of this country, that would threaten you. Even if it was just in South Carolina, if successful, it would be making its way to Central Texas, right? So, war for self-defense, even for commie collective self-defense, is one thing. Wars of aggression are something entirely different. And signing up to make money fighting aggressive wars of imperial domination of foreign countries is not service to your country. It's not defending your country. It's not fighting for freedom. And as you know, that sounds silly to some, like, yeah, we know that, Scott. What are we, stupid? But on the other hand, there are people who, particularly those who fight in the military, and probably many of the independent contractors too, who really do believe that, you know, hey, I'm not a decision maker type. If George Bush says this is the right thing to do, then I believe him and I'm going to serve my country by, you know, violently defending it from the people Bush says it needs defending from. And if that means, you know, forcefully occupying a country and creating our own government to rule it, then I guess I'll do that too. People do believe that they're fighting for their country. And there are, again, are others, or yet there are others who know better and have found out the hard way, have come home from Iraq and had time, since they don't have legs anymore, to use the search engine and find out what the hell they were doing there in the first place. And so in any case, it's not service. It's not national defense. It's aggressive imperial war. And, you know, I'm not a commie. I'm a libertarian, pro-capitalist, Declaration of Independence kind of guy, man. But that's just the fact, Jack. You don't have to be a leftist to understand that this is an empire and that you can't have, I don't know, freedom while you have a world empire. You might have a high standard of living for a while as you loot everyone through war and inflation, but it's not liberty. And, you know, the slightest glance at the newspaper on any given day will reveal new laws being passed to restrict your liberty and give government unprecedented amounts of access to your life, you know, basically daily. So, it's not service to your country. Another excuse for joining the military is you gotta grow up. It's time for you to quit clowning around and being a teenager, man. You've always been a slacker, and you've gotten fired from 4 jobs already, young man, and you got to get your life straight, boy. And you got to join that military, and they'll make a real man out of you. And this is the one that they show on the commercial all the time. Wow, son, I'm really impressed. This is the first time you've ever looked me in the eye. Wow, really? Boy, what kind of family do they live in, man? Never looked your dad in the eye before until the military had you murder people, huh? And now you're hard enough that you can look your dad in the eye? Okay, that's a good enough reason to go kill strangers on the word of Dick Cheney. You know, I got advice for you. Those of you, and I've met people like this. In fact, you know, working for antiwar.com and answering many of the letters to the editor, I've had kids write in and say, you know, I really got some problems. I've been, you know, doing drugs I shouldn't be doing. I drink way more than I should. I'm still living with my parents. I'm, you know, 20 and a half, and my dad's right. I'm a loser, and what am I going to do? So I think I'm going to join the military. Do you know any good reasons why I shouldn't? You know, those thought processes exist out there. People are going through that out there. Young men are going through that right now. And the answer is, look, man, if you're grown up enough to recognize that you need to grow up and that maybe you need to join the military to do so, then you're grown up enough to do it your damn self. I mean, how is it, you know, growing up to have, you know, the military break you down and build a new character out of you and send you off to kill people? You know, I don't know. And here's the other thing. if none of those arguments are good enough for you and you do go and join the military and they tell you, yeah, you're going to be in charge of, you know, flying remote control planes like on the commercial. Oh, my job in the Army, I fly remote control planes. It's really fun. When they tell you that and you end up touring Iraq, playing the IED lottery with the Sunni insurgents in your aluminum Humvee, if you do come back, chances are the government's going to throw you in the garbage. If you are a regular listener to anti-war radio, then you probably heard Charles Goyette interview Joshua Kurz, who wrote this article in The Nation magazine, how Sergeant Towne lost his benefits, about Sergeant Towne and 22,500 other wounded American soldiers who have been classified as having a personality disorder that disqualifies them, and then they're less than honorably discharged and forever disqualified from receiving their medical benefits. So what, that's almost half of the 50,000 wounded then, right? My math may be off somewhere in there. But that's what Joshua Kurz reported. 22,500 injured American soldiers. Oh, I'm sorry. You're back in America now? Yeah, see, the thing is, your dear old uncle, Sam, has decided that he's not going to pay for you anymore. You're not going to get health care from him. All your benefits are denied, son, because you have a personality disorder, which, of course, is merely a term. It is nothing that exists in time and space that a man can measure. There's no such thing as a personality disorder. What does that mean? You're an asshole? And yet, 22,500 American soldiers have been denied their health benefits on returning from the Iraq War. That's according to the article, How Sergeant Towne Lost His Benefits in The Nation magazine. And you can hear the interview by Charles Goyette of Joshua Kurz at Anti-War Radio at antiwar.com. They will throw you in the garbage. They don't care about you. Yeah, make a man out of you and pay for your college and all this crap. You're cannon fodder. And they don't care about you. And when you come home, they will forget you exist. Oh, you're an individual with rights and dignity and so forth. Yeah, right. Not to them, you're not. And further, the post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a story I've been, really interested in since the first Gulf War. And George Carlin's great sketch in his show Jammin' in New York back in 1991. But this is something I've been trying to cover ever since I met a shell-shocked young man named James Massey up at Camp Casey, where Cindy Sheehan was harassing George Bush and trying to get a straight answer to her question, what noble cause? You keep saying this is a noble cause. Would you mind defining it, please? Remember that? Yeah, Cindy Sheehan. And I was up there, and I met this guy and interviewed him. His name was Jimmy Massey, and this is one of these guys who can't close his eyes without seeing dead kids. He's ruined, man. He is shell-shocked out of his mind. And he said he was lucky because he was coming down with it and having anxiety attacks and nightmares and everything while he was still in Iraq. But he told me that his buddies who were okay in Iraq and filled out their little questionnaire on their return home, that, yeah, I'm feeling okay. Once they got home, if they started having nightmares and freaking out, and every time they close their eyes, they see bodies of people they've killed, and it only gets worse and worse and worse to where they're literally breaking down. Oh, I'm sorry. You wrote on your chart before you left Iraq that you're just fine. So right now, you're just being a wimp. You need to, buck up, soldier. Go drink a beer, and you'll be fine. Post-traumatic stress disorder. Don't be a wimp. And, you know, of course, as George Carlin said, maybe if they still called it shell shock, people would have a little compassion for these guys, who most of whom believe they're serving and defending their country and have to deal. I'm not saying most of them have the PTSD. I'm saying most of those who do have the PTSD, who believe that they're serving their country and defending their country, who come home and are broken men. you know, at least for a time, are getting denied their health care. And I did an interview with a guy named Mark Bowl, who wrote a great article for Playboy magazine. I believe it was the March issue of Playboy magazine. It's just all about, you know, one of these guys, one of these soldiers came home from Iraq. I think he was in New Mexico or Arizona, shot himself in the head, and they found the note in his pocket that said, "Sorry, pal, you're denied. We're not going to treat you. You're just being a wimp. Suck it up." And so he blew his own brains out. So I guess I'm all out of reasons off the top of my head why you should not join the military. I understand their desperate circumstances. I understand there are broken families. I understand there are kids who feel like maybe their last chance is joining the Army and maybe getting a good education, you know, going in for a couple of years and coming out a full-grown man like they don't feel they are now, or whatever. But there are other ways to deal with these problems, and you don't have to be a government employee, and certainly you don't have to be a government employee in charge of killing people. Oh, and here's another thing I want to point out about that. All the training and all the focus of the Army once you join it is about your 5 and 10 best friends. Yeah, they don't teach you nothing about the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, what your oath is to. They don't teach you Arabic. They don't teach you the difference between a Sunni and a Shia and what they may be fighting over. But what they teach you is undying loyalty to each other, which, of course, is the honorable and heroic and glorious part of war, right? The band of brothers who went through hell and came out alive and all that kind of thing. And if you read the press about the soldiers in Iraq, as much as they're covered, which is not very much, actual stories of the guys in battle, but you'll hear often stories of guys who are physically and mentally injured, and really shouldn't be out there, or, you know, maybe are getting away with it, but, who could go home. But instead, nope, you know, I'm not going home while my guys are out there risking their lives. If any of them are gonna die, I'm gonna die that day too, man, because I'm not gonna have it on my conscience that my guys died and I wasn't there. And that's very powerful emotions, right? This is like the very core of what it means to be a human being, right? And yet the government exploits that. The government trains these cohesive little units so that they think of nothing else but their 5 or 10 best friends in their unit. That it doesn't matter whether they're in a foreign country that never attacked them. Doesn't matter that the war against their government that had never attacked them was overthrown 4 years ago. That the war's been over for 4 years and yet still they're occupying and brutalizing people. Doesn't matter that, wow, we're helping the Iranians take over the south of Iraq? That's kind of weird. Why am I fighting to ensure that policy? They don't question those things. Because they're only concerned about each other, and the government exploits those basic human emotions in order to make better servants, better killers out of American soldiers. And it's unconscionable, and, you know, I can't imagine letting somebody do that to me and exploit me in that way. And, you know, of all the times I've ever said on the radio, young kids, please don't join the Army. It's all lies. They lie to you. Man, they'll tell you that you can do this job and that job, but they'll put you where they want. Once you sign that piece of paper, they can do whatever they want with you. And I, of all the times I've said this, I don't know if I've ever, you know, dissuaded a single person, but I still think it's worth it to try. Shit, my phone connection thing broke here and you guys weren't calling anyway, so I'm just going to keep talking. I thought it was hilarious that the 9/11 kooks all are celebrating the fact that Rosie O'Donnell has come and joined their side. Wow, isn't it great? Did you hear about Rosie O'Donnell? Yeah, she admitted it finally on TV about the bombs all in the towers. Now, man, if that doesn't tell you something, yeah, Rosie O'Donnell, when she's not trying to take my guns, and when, you know, her mouth isn't just bleeding, you know, garbage, I couldn't stand to hear her for more than 5 seconds, when she's not ruining forever the character of Barney Rubble's wife, Betty, for all time. I mean, Rosie O'Donnell as Betty? What the hell is that? John Goodman was good as Fred, but yeah, when Rosie O'Donnell is not opening her gigantic hippopotamus mouth to, you know, reveal more complete inanities that could never be accurate or informed or thoughtful or intelligent in any way, when she's not doing that, she's right about 9/11. She's heroic for telling the truth to all the people out there. Yeah. Okay, well, Rosie O'Donnell doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. And I'm sorry for picking a fight about 9/11 on the radio in Austin. I really shouldn't do it, but man, that shit is silly. Come on, guys. You know, after all this time, is there one shred of positive evidence of a single demolition bomb going off anywhere? No. Just bullshit. Just conjecture. You know what the 9/11 bombs in the tower stuff reminds me of? It reminds me of Abram Shulsky and Doug Feith and Scooter Libby and, Michael Ledeen and Michael Rubin and all these neoconservatives who helped cherry pick lies and half-truths out of the CIA's garbage can and use it to build a case to go to war. Oh, yes, all this is true because we have this, 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 and that. And see, it's all documented and it's all factual. And yet none of those this, 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 and that really hold up by themselves. None of them. And so what's 0 times 10, children? Right, 0. I don't know. I just, Rosie O'Donnell is our champion. That, to me, if I had to think that to myself, I would think, wait a minute. Maybe it's me. Maybe I got something wrong here. Maybe I should go back and double check. Because, you might have a great narrative about how the government did 9/11 from beginning to end and all that stuff, but what if none of it's true? You know, what if it sounds good as a story or something, but, what if all those ones that you claim are just zeros? And also, I need to take this time to reiterate from the radio show yesterday. If you missed it, go to antiwar.com and check out the archive of my interview with Philip Giraldi, former CIA covert operative type, paleoconservative, writes for Pat Buchanan's magazine, the American Conservative magazine, and he's been warning against war in Iran since 2005 publicly. And I interviewed him yesterday, and we talked about the recent developments. I'm not saying I buy this, but I am passing on this information because it was reported pretty far and wide and deserves bringing up and commenting on, and that is that the Russians and the French papers have just over the weekend and I guess last Thursday or Friday, I'm sorry. But anyway, over the past, 3 or 4 days, 5 days maybe, have been reporting that America is preparing for airstrikes, maybe even just a 48-hour campaign, I think I read one of them said a 24-hour bombing campaign against Iran. And some of the rumors are, and these I believe were from the Russian and the French papers, that the war is scheduled to take place Good Friday, this Friday. And I don't know if that's the case, and I'm not making the prediction, but I am passing that on. I think it's just as likely it'll happen this weekend as this summer, or, for that matter, not at all, because ultimately, as Philip Giraldi pointed out yesterday, all the assets required are already in the region. The battle plans are already drawn up, and they can do it whenever they want or not, and it's basically up to the President of the United States. I hope you didn't miss it, but the much ballyhooed anti-war bill passed to simply public relations effect, according to the Democrats who passed it, knowing Bush would veto it and admitting beforehand that they're going to turn around and pass whatever appropriations bill for this war that he wants after he vetoes this one. But anyway, there was a provision in there that reminded the President of the United States, it was not any new power being levied against him or anything, it simply reminded the President that he does not have the authority to begin a war against Iran unless he comes to Congress and receives a so-called authorization from them, which means they don't declare war but pass that responsibility to him. And Nancy Pelosi went up in front of the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee and was booed I think it was when she was talking about Iraq, but also the New York Sun, the Associated Press as well, but especially the New York Sun did an in-depth report about how, I think it was Eli Lake wrote it, about how the Israel lobby intervened with Nancy Pelosi and told her to take that provision that would have ordered Bush to come back to Congress before bombing Iran out of this new so-called anti-war authorization timetable bill that the House and Senate have now passed. And Nancy Pelosi went back to her office at the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House, that is, and she removed that statement in that bill that said, Mr. President, you may not bomb Iran unless you come to us and get approval from us first. And she took that out, which is a perfect green light for Dick Cheney, George Bush, and the neo-crazies, as Gordon Prather calls them, to initiate an aggressive war against Iran. Iran, which for the 9 millionth time over these airways, does not have a nuclear weapons program. Iran, which the CIA and the Mossad agree does not have a nuclear weapons program. Iran, which has a fledgling, tiny little international atomic energy agency monitored uranium enrichment program, which is barely successful at all and has continued technical problems using first generation centrifuges and has succeeded in enriching only a small amount of uranium to a measly 3.6%, which can never be used to make an atomic weapon. That Iran, they have the green light to go ahead and attack that country that is not a threat. You know, they talk about Iran intervening in Iraq. Yeah, they're supporting the same guys we are. And that's an excuse for war? Come on. Captured 15 British soldiers who, when the same thing happened 3 years ago, they just negotiated their release and it was not a casus belli whatsoever. We're supposed to believe that that's one now. I don't buy it, and I hope that you don't either. You should also know, just to fill in gaps if you don't, that the USS Eisenhower and Stennis strike carrier strike groups are in the region right now. I don't think they're in the Persian Gulf, but they're just outside the Persian Gulf, basically in the Indian Ocean there. And the USS Nimitz carrier strike group is on its way. I will caution that the military in their press release said, no, don't be a conspiracy nut and think this is about war with Iran, because the Nimitz is simply replacing the Eisenhower. They are not going to all three be in theater at the same time. But then again, these guys are liars and murderers, so you can't believe a word that they say. And there will be three carriers in the region before too long, and I'm sorry, I don't know which is the good website to go to track every strike carrier group on Earth and their position all the time. There probably is one. But the minesweepers are already in place. They have been since, they left last fall, so they've been there for a few months now anyway. And the new head of CENTCOM, that is a central command that controls military actions in the Middle Eastern region, is now a Navy admiral named Fallon. And, of course, his expertise is fighting wars, and particularly fighting air wars, naval air wars, and not fighting, you know, homegrown insurgencies like what our soldiers are now facing in Iraq. So, again, I'm not trying to just cry wolf and make predictions because, you know, I don't have any real secret information that ain't just out in the media somewhere. But it looks like America and the right wing crazies in the White House and in Israel want to initiate an aggressive war against Iran, who we've been fighting so valiantly for in Iraq for the past 4 years. Makes no sense to me, but there you go. I wanted to make a comment about McCain in Baghdad and him claiming that everything's fine. And here's McCain, walking through a marketplace surrounded by soldiers with unmanned aerial vehicles everywhere and helicopters and snipers. And then it's already up on antiwar.com that as soon as McCain was gone, people were attacked in that very marketplace. He was made a fool of by Michael Ware, who is Time Magazine's bureau chief in Baghdad, who, when McCain said, ah, come on, Baghdad's not that bad, Americans can go walking around in all different neighborhoods there. And he said that to Wolf Blitzer on CNN, and Wolf Blitzer got Michael Ware, the Australian reporter, the again, the Time bureau chief in Baghdad, on the live satellite link and said, hey, Michael Ware, John McCain says that Americans can go walking around in neighborhoods in Baghdad and that it's all good. And Michael Ware said, oh, really? I'm not sure which neighborhood in Neverland the senator is referring to, but he said, Wolf, you wouldn't last 20 minutes out there, pal. No American would, unless they're surrounded by U.S. military. Give me a break. So there's Mr. Straight Talk Express, John McCain, for you. And, yeah, I just want to assert real quickly that if the media would actually show pictures of the war, I don't know how many times on MSNBC I have seen the same picture of the same building get blown up. I mean, if you watch MSNBC, you know the one I'm talking about. They show it every day, 10 times a day or whatever. They're like, yeah, here's the battle in Baghdad. Yes, this is the same picture of the same building blowing up that we've been showing you for 3 years. And that's it. That's right. No, you can't hear anybody screaming. There's no dead bodies anywhere. I mean, you would think that when Iraqis die, they just evaporate like on a video game, you know? They just don't show it on American TV. And I think if they did, the war would have been long over. Of course, probably 100 people have written that the lesson, the big lesson of the Vietnam War from the military's point of view, one of the major lessons, was that you don't let the military, the media have unrestricted access to the soldiers and what's going on. Because if the American people can see what's going on, they might not want an empire at that cost. They might start to see Iraqis as humans instead of cartoon characters, and that just won't do. And so the media is very tightly controlled, not just by, you know, military censors and embedding and all that crap, but in self-censorship by all the corporate media. The government wants to have this war, and they don't want to intervene in that. No, they don't. So if the government wants the war to continue, they'll continue to be good, good little TV channels and just not show us the reality of the war in Iraq. They haven't since April of 2003. And, you know, the interview that you just heard with Sami Rasuli talking about the different factions in Iraq and what they're fighting for and who's allied with who and who's backed up by who and how much influence they have, you can't hear that anywhere. You can read it, you know, you can read it at Juan Cole's blog and you can read it at antiwar.com and a lot of other places, I guess, online. But you can't see that on TV in this country. Maybe occasionally on PBS, but even then, not with, you know, even as much context as you can hear here on anti-war radio on Chaos in Austin, Texas. And I think that's a damn shame. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and play y'all some music and call it a day. This has been Anti-War Radio for April 3rd, 2007. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow from 11 to 1.
through my brain. With me every day, drives me insane.